All right, so welcome, Zero Books listeners and viewers, to Pop the Left. I'm back again with Derek Varn, and we are going to be discussing Ferdinand LaSalle, the Social Democratic Party, Germany's Social Democratic Party, and the history of social democracy, I guess. It seems like a relevant thing to discuss today, just as both the Social Democratic wing in the UK and in the United States have fallen away, to kind of consider what socialism's relationship has been historically to social democracy. And I think LaSalle would be a fair way to start on that question. What do you think?
I think it's a very good way, partly because I think a lot of Marxists have LaSallian notions of the state, even if they accept the critique of the Goethe program. So, you know, I'll get to that, but I mean, that's a pretty big distinction. And I think people will be shocked a bit at some of the implications of the differences between LaSalle and Marx, because most Marxists, I don't think, take a lot of these distinctions as seriously as they did at the time. Mm-hmm. But I also will go into biographical reasons why that's a little bit more complicated, because I think one of the things you have to deal with LaSalle is the fact that Marx, you know, Marx said some nasty things about him. Marx actually, you know, in addition to writing his paper, but was also in correspondence with him, cried at his funeral. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things you have to look at. You know, LaSalle wrote pamphlets trying to popularize Karl Marx's early works. Mm-hmm. He also was part of the recruitment of August Babel, the real representary and like fighting man head of the early SPD. Mm-hmm. So you can't really cut him out yet. Surprisingly, he kind of has been cut out. I mean, most people only know him as like, oh, that guy who wrote that program that Marx kind of complained about in a secret letter to Engels. It wasn't published.
Right. Well, I thought we might start our discussion, but that maybe my big contribution to this conversation would be to read Hal Draper aloud. Mm-hmm. I'm tempted to read the whole section. It's not too long. I'll see how it goes. But this is from The Two Souls of Socialism, Section 5, LaSalle and State Socialism. And he starts, "That very model of a modern social democracy, the German Social Democratic Party, is often represented as having arisen on a Marxist basis. This is a myth, like so many else in extant histories of socialism. The impact of Marx was strong, including on some of the top leaders for a while, but the politics which permeated and finally pervaded the party came mainly from two other sources. One was LaSalle, who founded German socialism as an organized movement in 1863, and the other was the British Fabians, who inspired Edward Bernstein's revisionism. Ferdinand LaSalle is a prototype of the state socialist, which means one who aims to get socialism handed down by the existing state. He was not the first prominent example. That was Louis Blanc. But for him, the existing state was the Kaiser's state under Bismarck. The state, LaSalle told the workers, is something that will achieve for each one of us what none of us could achieve for himself. Marx taught the exact opposite, that the working class had to achieve its emancipation itself and abolish the existing state in the course. Bernstein was quite right in saying that LaSalle made a veritable cult of the state, the immemorial vestal fire of all civilization, the state. I defend with you against those modern barbarians, the liberal bourgeoisie, LaSalle told a Prussian court. This is what made Marx and LaSalle fundamentally opposed, points out LaSalle's biographer, Footman, who lays bare his pro-Prussian, pro-Prussian nationalism, pro-Prussian imperialism. LaSalle organized this first German socialist movement as his personal dictatorship. Quite consciously, he set about building it as a mass movement from below to achieve a socialism from above. The aim was to convince Bismarck to hand down concessions, particularly universal suffrage, on which basis a parliamentary movement under LaSalle could become a mass ally of the Bismarckian state in a coalition against the liberal bourgeoisie. To this end, LaSalle actually tried to negotiate with the Iron Chancellor. I'm going to skip over this bit. Instead of the revolutionary process of transformation of society, wrote Marx, LaSalle sees socialism arising from the state aid that the state gives to the producers' cooperative societies in which the state, not the worker, calls into being. Marx derides this, but as far as the present cooperative societies are concerned, they are of value only insofar as they are the independent creations of the workers and not proteges either of the government or of the bourgeoisie. Here is a classic statement of the meaning of the word independent as the keystone of the socialism from below versus state socialism. There is an instructive instance of what happens when an American-type academic anti-Marxist runs into this aspect of Marx. Mayo's Democracy and Marxism handily proves that Marxism is anti-democratic mainly by the simple expedient of defining Marxism as the Moscow Orthodoxy. But at least he seems to have read Marx and realized that nowhere, in acres of writing and a long life, did Marx evince concern about more power for the state, but rather the reverse. Marx, it dawned on him, was not a statist. And I'll read the last bit. This discovery offers a notable challenge to Marx critics, who of course know in advance that Marxism must glorify the state. Mayo solves the difficulty in two statements. First, the statism is implicit in the requirements of total planning. And second, look at Russia. But Marx made no fetish of total planning. He has so often been denounced by other Marx critics for failing to draw up a blueprint of socialism precisely because he reacted so violently against his predecessor's utopian planism, or planning from above. Planism is precisely the conception of socialism that Marxism wished to destroy. Socialism must involve planning, but total planning does not equal socialism, just as any fool can be a professor, but not every professor need be a fool. So I enjoyed reading that, and I wanted to read it aloud, maybe partly for that last line. So there was a bit I skipped over, which had to do with LaSalle's relationship with Bismarck. Do you want to go into that?
Well, I will. I mean, the relationship to Bismarck was profound. In the early 1920s, there was a discovery of letters between LaSalle and Bismarck where LaSalle was trying to get concessions from the government after the passage of things like the prototypical anti-socialist laws. There's also, you know, he had a pretty close correspondence with Bismarck and had his ear. And some of the reforms he proposed after his death in the late 1860s were actually passed in the 1870s after the anti-socialist laws were in 1871. So he had an effect. One of the things, there's two things you have to deal with that. One of the things is that, like Marx, LaSalle is opposed to Hegelian. In fact, his first book is actually on Hegelian philosophy. Mm-hmm. Marx thought it was mostly a rehash of the philosophy of right and thus wasn't terribly interesting, but was important enough to comment on. So if you go back to Hegel also saw in the proto-Prussian state, you know, in this constitutional monarchism, a sort of dialectical perfect state that would lead to the advancement of freedom through the expansion of its way of life. You see that in philosophy of right, which Marx was a heavy critic on. You and I have talked about this years ago. Mm-hmm. And this informs a lot of what LaSalle is arguing for, because LaSalle, stemming from Hegel, sees the state as a fundamentally classless organ. He doesn't see the nation state and thus the state as exist as an extension of bourgeois power. He sees it as an abstraction from which legal absolutes can emerge. I also think there's a lot in here because in this concession to the Prussian government that informs both state socialism a la social democracy and state socialism a la Marxist-Leninism, there is a scholar who went through the typologies of socialism and drawn out from actually the political and economic manuscripts and the Critique of the Goethe program, Marx's theory. And one of the things Marx does is while the state withers away, the state withers away in classical Marxism in the like second stage of socialism. I mean, he doesn't make it that clear, but it's early.
Yeah.
Whereas later socialists assume that happens later because they follow LaSalle and Kautsky in thinking that the imminent collapse of the state would damage the social order by ending all these services that are tied up into the nation state, and thus putting the working class in a precarious position so that those had to be seized by the working class first and then phased out, probably, according to Lenin, as one of the final stages of into communism. Now, again, we all know that Marx used socialism and communism interchangeably and only staged them kind of as a fluke of wording in the Goethe program.
Right.
Elsewhere, he uses them kind of
synonyms.
As synonyms. But in the Goethe program, he does actually say, you know, lower state socialism, higher state socialism, and communism. Basically, the state fades away towards the end of lower state socialism, and most even communists assume that it fades away towards the development of communism. This seems like a small esoteric difference. It's really kind of not, if you actually think about what you're assuming the economy is doing and who's supporting it. If the state fades away early on, then it's not there. But it's also important to see Marx is also in this battle in the First International against, you know, the proto-social democrats in England and in Germany, all right? Mm-hmm. Who he's normally allied with against different forms of anarchists, particularly the anarcho-collectivist or the anarcho-communist, i.e. the Bakunin faction, who thought that the abolition of the state comes first before anything else, before even the abolition of private property and all that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So Marx is actually kind of a compromised position between these two things, but that's lost in the development of 20% century communism. And one of the things I think is interesting, though, to point out, that's not all LaSalle's fault. When LaSalle is popularizing communism, remember, his first membership in one of these secret political organs, he was a member of the Communist League with Marx.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Marx doesn't really start exchanging letters with him until the 1850s, I think. But they knew each other even that early, and he knew of LaSalle from the Communist League and his Hegelian scholarship even before that. That creates kind of an interesting deal if you look at back when we talked about two things, both the formation of the First International and the Communist Manifesto. One of the things that I pointed out in the Communist Manifesto is that its demands aren't that different from progressive bourgeois or social democratic demands. They're just not.
I want to pause you here, and because we can just keep going. I could just let you keep going and going, I know. But I want to go back to one of the things that you said early on about Hegel and Marx's understanding of LaSalle's regurgitation of Hegel and his critique of Hegel's philosophy of right, and just clarify what we both think, or at least what I think would be the major difference between Marx and Hegel when it came to the understanding of the source of power and society and where the dialectical engine of history resides as well. For Hegel, there seems to be a history of understanding that is acted out socially. And for Marx, that is also the case, but the difference is that it is acted out through modes of production. So it shapes how people cooperate together to produce their life. And I think that would be the key difference between Hegel and Marx. I mean, that's a very simplified difference, but the fact that labor, collective labor, social production in the material world is what is fundamental for Marx is, I think, what makes him a materialist rather than an idealist. And that, I think, informs his stance towards the state, because the state can be, in Marx and in Hegel's ideology or in Hegel's philosophy, a pure abstract force that, like at the end of the Phenomenology, that seems to understand, be the realm in which things are understood as self-contradictory, and where power can be put forward in a scientific way, which means in a way that's, I think, can be revised, that doesn't become a secular state, can be this sort of power. But for Marx, what stops a state from being able to deliver on a rational organization of society is the fact that it is actually reliant on another social relationship, which isn't purely political. It isn't about political power, but it's about how people are organized to produce.
Right.
And then this, in this material realm.
There are a few honest Stalinists. I think of Dominic Lacerda, who actually kind of take this view of the state. And I wanted to really dig into that, because that's important. And let's like step back a second and then dig into what that is. Because when we have gone over the Krieg and the Goethe program, we didn't talk about this background to what the Goethe program was. We may have talked a little bit about LaSalle's concessions to Bismarckian nationalism, but we didn't talk about the Hegelian reasons for it, and there are some.
Right. So
because LaSalle accepts, like, for example, Giovanni Gentile, all right, the prime philosopher of fascism in Italy, that the state is an emergence of a legal process. The legal process comes as the accumulation of the abstract will manifest in the contradictions of a whole social polity, you know, a people. LaSalle sees this as essentially classless, right? Because, but it's also important to remember, LaSalle is also a legal jurist. He works in law, all right? Part of how LaSalle, like Engels, you know, you have to deal with is he wasn't part of the working class at all. LaSalle had a pension from helping a noble win a lawsuit against her husband that he had 5,000, I think something like a pension of $5,000, equivalent to like a fair bit of money. Is it like 5,000 marks a year or something? But it's a lot for the time period, for the rest of his life, off of helping her win her estates back in this one lawsuit.
Wow.
So LaSalle is from the same class as Marx, but his fortune is different because he doesn't lose out as badly. He also actually has more street cred than Marx because he faces prison terms multiple times.
Yeah, he's constantly getting thrown in jail.
Yeah, for you know, seditious activity. So yeah. So he has both street cred and he has money. Otherwise, right. I mean, his background sounds identical to Marx. Marx is famous, you know, when people want to shame Marx, they'll bring up when he called LaSalle in a letter to Engels the German equivalent of a Jewish N-word. All right. What's ironic about that, actually, and this is not to absolve Marx of this in any way, is LaSalle's background and Marx's background are practically identical. They're both professors from a Jewish background who germified their name. I mean, in Marx's case, it had been done for him to hide their Jewish roots and fit and assimilate into German society. They never quite fit in. They're always in trouble with the law. It's just that LaSalle's basically better and more successful during his lifetime of actually earning money. But LaSalle, interestingly enough, too, also considers himself a student of Marx and Hegel. He doesn't actually perceive that the difference between his own position and Marx, even though Marx is so adamant about their opposition that he crypto keeps his own people from joining the General German Workers' Council, which becomes the basis of the SPD. We say he founded the SPD. He really founded the Coalition of Labor Movements. Mm-hmm. That founded the SPD. Another thing to remember that we talked about in the First International is these early groups are coalitions of unions. They're not originally formed out of like political parties like the Whigs or the Tories or the Democrats. They're political groups that come out of coalitions of what we say quasi or parapolitical actors. He founds the coalition in Germany, the kind of nationalist coalition, that makes up the core of the SPD and who gets it as first candidate. He didn't technically find the SPD directly because he was dead by that point. He died in a duel in 1868.
Guys in those days were just constantly dying in duels. It was like, it was a thing, I guess.
He was courting someone's girlfriend. There's an honor challenge. He gets shot in the gut.
One of us would be dead if we had lived through that time. One of us would have killed the other one.
I would have challenged you to a duel like four times. So there are those differences. There are other differences between LaSalle and Marx, but one of the things that makes it difficult is while Marx was advocating against LaSalle's political leadership, he actually, because he was so interested in keeping the German workers' movement together, wouldn't make any of this public. So LaSalle didn't actually know how different his opinion was from Marx.
That's interesting.
Even though they had exchanges and letters about it, and like Marx pushed back on him, but because Marx wouldn't publicly oppose him in the same way that like he opposed Proudhon or say maybe even Garibaldi or Bakunin, he was much more careful about that because he saw his allegiance with the workers' movement, you know, going, think about how he handled the International and his kind of alliance with LaSalle going all the way back to the Communist League as too important to risk making all these criticisms public beyond his immediate followers.
Right. Well, so let's come back again to that difference between Marx and LaSalle along the lines of the importance of the materialism of Marx, or the importance of focusing on productive activity and having an economy or an economic critique that is trying to understand productive activity as its own social relationship rather than as a natural force that then can be used by different kinds of societies. I think one thing that may come out of LaSalle's Hegelianism is his willingness to embrace Malthusian ideas and to think of and to come up with something like the iron law of wages, which
He didn't come up with it. It's kind of David Ricardo.
But Ricardo was more complicated than LaSalle was when it came to understanding wages. Ricardo saw more countervailing factors pushing against the iron law of wages. At least if I understand what the iron law of wages was, according to LaSalle, and you know he did pick it up from Ricardo, was that there's a tendency for wages to decline or drop to the level of subsistence wages.
And I mean, Marx actually more or less agrees with this, although he has used his bets more than Ricardo because the law.
But they have very different reasons for thinking this happens.
Well, yeah, they do.
LaSalle, and I'm not sure if this is true of Ricardo, saw that what will happen is that basically supply and demand will work out so that if you have wages too high, workers will they'll become an oversupply of workers, and that will bring the wages down to subsistence levels. And what that means is that basically if you give workers a high wage, they're gonna fuck a lot. and they're going to produce more working class people. And also maybe you'll get immigration as well. But there's a there's an automatic quality to this, which the workers are thought to have. Like, you know, workers are basically natural animals who will respond to their environment, and, you know, without rationality, just sort of respond like a bunch of rabbits. If you give them a bunch of cabbage, they'll reproduce more. Or carrots. But Marx saw something altogether different driving the relationship between workers and bosses and the wages that they could get, which was the value that the commodities embodied, the quantity of that value changing based on the productive activity of the workers, and that the wages could go up or down based on, you know, basically rates of profitability, as along with the supply and demand of labor. It's just a much more complicated theory, and also it's a theory based on a social relationship founded on equality rather than a domineering kind of relationship where the workers are thought of as basically animals.
Right. Well, there's two things to think about. All right, two things to think about when we deal with this. Like LaSalle, when David Ricardo came up with this theory, he actually thought of it as a theory of rents. And he thought of labor as a kind of rent form, which is different. Although, I mean, all of them actually accept the labor theory of value. So, like, supply and demand plays into it, but value is still based on labor, according to all of these economists. Where Marx takes an innovation from most classical economists, particularly Malthus and LaSalle, is Marx actually thinks private production can overcome the Malthusian calculus because of technological innovations, making commodity production more efficient, and thus being able to supply for the population. Marx actually sees this as kind of a good thing from capitalism. But LaSalle doesn't accept that. Part of that, I think, is LaSalle is also basing this off the German economy, which is still kind of quasi-feudal, as opposed to, I mean, he's basing off the Prussian economy and the Principate economies, as opposed to the English economy, which is, by this point, something that would be like agrarian capitalist proper. So what does this mean? Well, it means two things. LaSalle sees the state as not a class form. He sees it as an ideal form. Then the classes, any class can assume leadership.
And just to clarify again, classes arise based on the social relationship around production.
Right.
It's not like a caste system. He's not saying it's not. He doesn't have a materialist understanding of the state.
Right. Well,
and that's what it means to say he doesn't have a class understanding.
He didn't have a class understanding of the state because he didn't have a material understanding of the state. The state emerges as a way to mitigate the nation state in particular emerges as a way to mitigate between conflicts of kinds of capitalists. Now, this is interesting. Marx is basing this off the development of capitalism in France and England. In Germany at this time, we are still dealing with unification. So there's like kind of material reasons why LaSalle maybe not would not have seen this. He was not studying the English economy as much, even though he was definitely influenced by English economists like Malthus and Ricardo. And so Germany is kind of still developing its capitalism form. So what LaSalle argues is that because of this Malthusian calculus, the state has to step in and provide a means for this to happen. Since the state is an ideal form, and you can just assume ownership of it, you can use legal protections to stop to kind of countervene in the Malthusian problem. All right. So he thinks the state can fix the Malthus problem. All right. Mm-hmm. Marx says this is already fixed by capital. Right. And, you know, for all the fans of state socialism in this LaSallian form, Marx is right.
Yeah, I want to throw up a comment that's on from. We have somebody here who's a follower of ours who watches the channel, who calls himself State Socialism, and says, "What do you want? Unreliable libertarian mutual aid or the Social Security program and universal health care that's made reliable?" And I'm thinking, you know, from the
state, definitely is reliable as long as that state is functional on a capitalist world market and can sell stuff. You can't pull that stuff out of your ass. Right. Which, by the way, is what China doesn't. If we're going to use specific examples, China spends less per capita than Bulgaria on its health sector. The country, like Cuba, is actually way more advanced than China on healthcare, which doesn't make any sense given its developmental state as either a socialist or a capitalist nation. As a side note, I just want to throw some facts at some people.
Yeah.
As a side note from that, the point isn't that you would use mutual aid under capitalism or as like some kind of anarchist mutual aid to do this. Marx doesn't think you can immediately destroy the state. Marx thinks that once the state is a particular historical form of a particular kind of relationship, as is the sovereign in a feudal relationship,
right,
or the emperor in both late feudal and in early antique relationships. Those are different things in the modern nation state. Mm-hmm. Now, confusing the matter, though, is Marx seems to hedge his bets and allegiances on nation states all the time. We see this in 1848. We see it in the formation of the First International. We see it in Marx's acceptance that national liberation is a progressive function. But what Marx always says in the side notes of this is while states manage internal issues of peoples within capitalism, that capitalism is a world system which no state can control. So to fight capitalism, you have to develop something beyond the need of any nation state. And thus, eventually, you wouldn't even need the kinds of state acting forms wouldn't exist. Now, I know a lot of people in the chat are going to say this is Anglo-Saxon individualism or Marxist individualism. It's absolutely not, although collectivism versus individualism, as we and I both discussed, is not even Hegelian. It's some kind of weird antique thought. Mm-hmm. The Hegelian model says the individual is only possible because of the collective and vice versa. And what you have is the emergence of aggregate forms, aggregate being a bunch of individuals act together, are pushed together by historical circumstances to create these things. You know, these collectivist nationalist identities or whatever are actually partially constructed. Mm-hmm. And to do so has all kinds of problems. It has benefits in that you have efficiency in language, communication, education. It has problems in that it creates micronationalisms, opposing nationalisms, hatreds that weren't there before. And you see this in the economic sector. You have the simplification of the markets, but you also have monocropping, development of mass blights. Marx sees this as dialectics in production. A Hegelian ideal statist would not see it as that. They would probably deny it exists because they think the state can intervene against those things.
Right. So we've got state socialism, you know, saying things like, LaSalle disagreed and he was right, and the state will never wither away under socialism, and so on. And my thought about someone who's a follower of LaSalle today is that, you know, what we ought to do is look at their competing economic understandings and competing philosophical understandings of society and political understandings and projects, and, you know, argue them out. And also look at the history. Unfortunately, when it comes to the history of Marxism, it's not so simple to figure out what was the consequence of Marx's thought and what was the consequence of LaSallianism or a variety of other thinkers.
Yeah, because Bernstein is super influenced. Bernstein, you know, evolutionism, the evolution of the automatic evolution of bourgeois state into socialism, which was picked up by like even capitalist critics of socialism, like Schumpeter, that the capitalist forces themselves would cause state responses, which would develop towards socialism. Bernstein actually took that position, mostly from LaSalle, just adding in some kind of evolution theories to it. Mm-hmm. Most social democrats are at some level LaSallians. People who think that economies can be, can that nationalization as opposed to socialization can be the answer to most economic problems are being highly influenced by LaSalleism. What makes that more complicated, though, is you have nationalization calls in the Communist Manifesto. And it is only later, particularly Engels, and you know, Engels we would actually see as somewhat, maybe even slightly more sympathetic to LaSallianism than Marx. Mm-hmm. Engels, however, points out that nationalism and socialism are not the same thing. The nationalization may be necessary for socialization to happen, but it's not actually the same call. And he critiques Kautsky for picking this up from the LaSallian faction of the SPD into the Erfurt program, where he sends about where he like he Engels signs off on the Erfurt program, kind of saying Marx would have agreed to it, with the caveat that socialization is not nationalization, and Kautsky, you need to make this explicit and make this understood, otherwise we cannot agree to this program.
Yeah, I had an argument with someone who's one of our authors that got rather heated precisely on this point about socialization and what socialization really meant from a Marxist point of view. And one thing that what I said, and I think it's true and needs to be considered, is that socialization had a couple of different meanings. One of the things about socialization is that Marx saw capitalism itself as a force for socialization, because it brought people together off of their private land and brought them together to socially produce the world through the mechanism of capital accumulation. So if you're arguing for the state as a force for socialization, well, it might be, but so is capitalism itself on that level. If you want to argue that the state is a force for socialism, that's you can't confuse statism with socialism in the process. You have to make an argument for that as a process rather than the state control of the economy as the end, as socialism.
Right. I mean, when Marx's critique of, say, Bakhtinism was that, like, if it collapsed all forms of the state when there's still capitalist economies in existence with capitalist nation states, they're just going to crush us. We're not going to be able to coordinate. Also, we'll have, there's all these things that have not, you know, that are, that division of labor is still highly centralized in state cartelized division of labors. We haven't divided that. You know, he strongly critiqued LaSalle for stuff that we would be highly surprised of. Like he thought that public education should be funded maybe by the state, and that teachers should be licensed by the state, but the state should not control education, which right. I think shocks most Marxists. You know, one of the things that you understand about Marxism versus LaSallianism is LaSallianism is, even though it sees itself as Marxist, comes, it's not actually that much against what you see in the manifesto, except that LaSalle takes a more negative tone towards the progressive bourgeoisie. As you see in his later arguments and his addresses to the state, he thought the progressive bourgeoisie was a threat. He became more nationalistic as he got older, and basically is kind of the founder of what we see now as like red-brown allegiance.
Right.
I mean, seriously, like this idea that
was the whole thing with Bismarck, right?
I mean, right. Mm-hmm. You can appeal to these conservative factions against these progressive, socially alienated, cosmopolitan bourgeoisie for these nationalist interests. And this, of course, turns Marx's stomach. I mean, Marx actually, like, those are the only parts of capitalism he likes.
Right.
And sees that as how capitalism liberated us from the feudal sphere. And the LaSallian does not. I think a lot of, like, you know, we'll talk about this more on the second half, but I think a lot of, not just social democracy, not just certain kinds of Marxist-Leninism, but even a lot of, say, like, modern Marxist analysis, like world systems theory, which assumes that core-periphery relations' primary distinctions are in the level of states, in nation-states in particular, have totally LaSallian assumptions, and they don't even know it. And that's, you know, and part of that is because descriptively they're not wrong about, say, how nation states work. If you look at the way nation states work qua nation states, although if you apply that same analysis to the nation states themselves, it actually starts to fall apart. You see core and periphery areas within the nation state. And that's consistent with Marxism, but not much so much consistent with the state socialism notion.
Right.
And the other thing that you see in the state socialists is they become more nationalist and more imperialist and most chauvinistic over time. And I'll give Marxist-Leninism this. They were weary of that element of this, and they saw that in social democracy early on. And Kautsky's refusal to take a side on this as part of the problem that led to Nazi, you know, that they would say, argue at least into the third period, led to Nazism in Germany. I mean,
who would argue that? Not Marx, he was long dead, but who would argue that Kautsky's position led to Nazism?
Like ultra left communists and even some Trotskyists would say that Kautsky's position, the sitting on his hands, effectively sided with the chauvinistic forces of socialism, who like actually did historically hire and build up the Freikorps. Now that ignores that, for example, Kautsky and Bernstein were actually on the anti-imperial side later and were also strongly against the nationalist forces in the 20s. But, you know, if you kind of take an objective analysis, you know, and then also only listen to Lenin's polemics, distancing himself from Kautsky beyond that point, you could sort of make that argument. I think it's actually kind of weak, but what I do think is key to that is Kautsky also was in the same bind as Marx and Engels were. Okay, Marx and Engels knew from the First International and its falling apart between the Bakuninists and the British labor unionists that they didn't want that to happen to the German workers' movement. And they couldn't let that happen to the proto-SPD. Even if Marx encouraged his people not to join that at first, that once it existed, that was what they had to work with. So as you and I talked about, one of the most important documents to understanding Marxism is suppressed by Marx himself to make sure that the SPD is not killed on arrival by this distinction. And also, you know, even though he said horrible things about LaSalle, I mean, he called LaSalle the German equivalent of a Jewish immigrant.
You know, when you said that before, you mentioned that he called LaSalle like a slur that was similar to the N-word, only aimed at Jews. And
No, he actually said Jewish N-word.
Oh, is that right?
The German equivalent of the N-word.
Oh, okay.
And I've looked at it in German. I've looked at the letter. He wrote it to Engels. But like I said, the other funny thing about that is Marx is also a swarthy complexion Jewish.
Right. Well, there was a guy recently, I don't remember his name, but he was talking about Bernie Sanders' team. Mm-hmm. And he was a black commentator who prides himself to be intersectional. And he was saying, you know, these black women who are supporting Bernie Sanders, you know, I don't care for them. They're from the island of mixed up black girls and they don't impress me or something like that. And he was using this sort of same, I mean, if a white person had said it, it would have been way off the charts, but it was pretty off the charts anyway, the way he was racializing his low estimation of them had a racialized component. Anyway, I feel like it's a different scenario when people who are of the same ethnicity trade those kinds of insults in general. I don't know if that's too simple-minded, but I think it's
a black spot on Marx's record, but I don't think it's a particularly hard one. They're the same ethnicity. They have the same background. And Marx didn't say it in public. He never used that kind of language in public, which was actually pretty common at the time. Right. So I do think it's a black spot on Marx's record, but I also don't think Marx is a saint, and it doesn't really matter if he was always perfect. And his opinions about LaSalle are complicated. When LaSalle dies, Marx laments that they lost a hero of the German workers' movement. Mm-hmm. Because, like, one of the things LaSalle's group does is because LaSalle's private pressure on Bismarck and the group's labor agitation and Babel's active participation in the Prussian Parliament actually does lead to full male enfranchisement pretty early on. And that happened almost nowhere else before then. Enfranchisement was always violent. And so Marx recognizes this as good. Engels actually did think, for example, that the democratic participation of the proletariat through full suffrage, a la LaSalle, could actually lead to something like the beginnings of a worker state, which then would incur the need for revolution because of a defensive posture. Mm-hmm. Now, Marx was more agnostic about this than Engels seems to have been. This is later writing after Marx is dead. Marx's own political economic manuscripts say all sorts of things. And the dictatorship of the proletariat is not established democratically. But Marx does see like the revolution may be defensive more than offensive because of universal suffrage and the proletarianization of Europe.
Okay. You know, what brings to mind for me is our previous conversation on Taylorism.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it's directly related.
Yeah, because Marx, you know, like LaSalle will have this sort of vision of what his political project is, and he'll try to use whatever powers are around to enact it, right? And Marx is wanting to develop working class power, and so he can't be opportunistic exactly, but he does try to tail the real conditions or what's imminent in the moment to try to find the best aspects or the most progressive aspects of the politics that are going on and lend support to those. But he's always sort of trying to second guess what the future is going to be and figure out what's really existing now that can be supported to lead towards a socialist outcome, which means the outcome where the working class take power and transform the social relations. But it just seems like he doesn't have the same kind of political projects or political ambitions, and certainly not he's not someone who would, like Elizabeth Warren, come up with 1,000 plans to implement his ideas.
No. And in fact, actually, it's even more problematic than that. So, you know how we talked about in the Enlightenment, particularly before 1848, there's this Enlightenment tension between enlightened despotism and democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, LaSalle, towards the end of his life, and there's no reason not to think this was sincere. Actually really, really, really seemed to doubt, even though he was a Republican and was a form of Republican Democrat, he actually was cryptically a supporter of constitutional monarchism with a strong monarch, and he was against Republican constitutionalism. Mm-hmm. Because he thought it was easier for the working class to pressure a monarch, one person, mm-hmm. than it was for them to pressure a constitutional assembly. And because he thought that basically constitutionalism was too idealistic about planning. So he was actually in favor of enlightened despotism with some constitutional overreach, which Marx utterly rejected. Even though Marx was accused of basically holding the same opinion. Now, this was stated, I think, in a letter. You got to find where this is actually. I think he stated it in a letter to Bismarck, so it wasn't commonly known, but LaSallians are where you get this idea of, instead of a dictatorship of the proletariat, you get a dictatorship for the proletariat. This is explicitly in LaSalle's thought, even if he doesn't express it, because he doesn't trust democratic systems to do this. And Marx, you know, realizes that democratic systems in the capital are a problem, particularly because the nation state itself is a capitalist formation, and thus you need a dictatorship of the proletariat to create a class dictatorship to create the conditions of who can be excluded, you know, kind of as a temporary sovereign, to then establish universal sovereignty after everyone's been proletarianized.
Mm-hmm.
That LaSalle just doesn't see this as a viable answer. And in some ways, even though like LaSalle thought he was a disciple of Marx, what Marx actually believes is somewhere in between Bakunin on one end and LaSalle on the other.
You know what? We've got people chatting, and I want to throw this up on the screen here. Someone says, Doug is a textbook platformist. Chill out. I'm not sure who they're talking to.
Platformism is the Marx is anarcho-Marxism. So some left comms, some Marxist humanist, and say anarchists who have critiques of Marxism historically for being too soft on LaSallianism, actually, such as Wayne Price, are platformist. I don't know if you're
my understanding of platformism comes from reading Anarchy magazine in the 90s. And you don't want to be called a platformist because they're authoritarian, according to the Anarchy magazine, you know, green primitivist groups in the Pacific Northwest in 1995. But remind me of why it's called platformism precisely. What's
it's because you have a platform and not a program, and because, you know, working class creates working class platforms for their advocacy. So you have platforms of confederation and basically autonomous councilists and syndicalists who kind of cooperative together in these creating these platform planks. At least that's the way it was articulated when I read Wayne Price, the anarchist who has a soft spot for Marxism on the whole thing. Left communists range in their answers to that, from councilism to, you know, kind of like hyper-Leninism a la Bordiga. And so it's kind of complicated. All of these answers, including even Bordiga's, because Bordiga doesn't trust the nation state, are anti-LaSallian. So,
right. Yeah, I don't think it's fair to say that I'm a platformist, only because it's not fair to the platformists who probably are thinking politically more, you know, thoroughly than I am. I'm trying to work out, you know, where I would land. But I certainly have a history of anarchist thought in my background. You know, like I come out of the Pacific Northwest, hippy dippy anarchist, Anarchy magazine, pro situ kind of scene. So all right. It's not surprising that I would be that way.
I have an interesting question that come up in the chat that I actually do want to address.
Okay, where is it?
Joseph, did the specter of LaSallian crypto-nationalism haunt the post-war revolutionary movements, I guess in post-World War I? And I would say sort of. Part of the problem with saying it's simply LaSallianism is that the consensus answer through Lenin was not national chauvinism and like an imperial state like Bismarckianism taking over the world. That's kind of what LaSalle argues, and for some degree even Bernstein a little bit, even though he's against war. It's that because of national liberation, which is in Marx and Lenin, and you know, this goes back to Marx, internationalism is seen as there are no more nation states, but nationalities have autonomous, like, you know, Soviets are their own parties that can advocate for their national interests and preservation of culture in the Soviet system. Well, the problem with sorting out former empires that were multi-ethnic in the 19th century is you have to create nation states. So following Lenin's advice, which actually Stalin objected to, and I actually understand Stalin's objections because he came from Georgia, whether it's a bigger deal, you had to create nation states for all these groups. When that started happening, but they started resisting the centralization of the Soviet apparatus, and you also had other groups like, say, Bordiga's PCI, before Gramsci, also resisted this. He argued that all nations need to be represented equally in the Comintern, and that without so, you don't have a true representation of the proletariat, and the Russian proletariat cannot take precedence, no matter where you came in the revolutionary struggle. That you needed national representation to really do this. And the Bolsheviks took it serious enough to start creating language. Like they created the Turkmen language as written form, and they did all kinds of stuff. They helped people invent national mythologies. But when there was resentment towards Soviet centralization and the centralization towards the Soviet state, of course, this led to new nationalisms. Stalin's response to that after his sorting of Europe was Russification, because he gave up on the nationalist party, even though the international of nations and national autonomy, particularly, I mean, like, you know, you have the creation of the Jewish autonomous zone, even though Lenin didn't think Jews were their own nation within Russia. And then, you know, towards the end of his life, Stalin's like, screw it, that doesn't work. Israel, seriously, you know, despite, you know, Bolshevik stances later. This leads to the Stalinism kind of creeping back in, but also it's kind of a result of the tension between the universalism implicit in Marxism and the idea of particular interest in internationalism and particular peoples and internationalism in Marxism too. So there's kind of a Marxist contradiction there that hasn't really ever been solved, that I think LaSalle presents a very attractive chauvinist answer for. And So I don't think it's LaSalle's total fault, but I do think it's kind of a natural construction of that tension that emerges in
Explain that tension again in the international.
Communism is supposed to be a universal system, but it's also supposed according to Marx, particularly, to not have it repeat capitalist imperialism. It's supposed to respect the ethnic or national interests of certain groups, particularly conquered groups, including groups that never had their own nation state. All right.
Yeah, but in what context are you talking about that this respect is supposed to be going on?
They have autonomous political rights. They don't have rights against, like, you know, they're not supposed to have rights against, like, socialist production.
To say they are to have autonomous political rights assumes, for instance, that what we understand as political is going to continue on forever. I think you have to put it in the context of the day in which you're talking about, in the current, in the struggle of the 19th century, international solidarity between working class people who were also struggling to create independence and working on national independence and saw themselves within economies where they had their own national interests as well, was a problem.
Well, but you don't get out of this in the 20th century, though. I mean, like,
no, I'm not saying you get out of it in the 20th century, but I'm saying that in fact, the 19th century efforts for socialism, and from my perspective, basically failed, and the problem only deepens in the 20th century. But the aim is not so much. I mean, if you could create a working class based economy. In other words, if you could transform the social relationships and change the material basis of society, which is the aim of Marxism, then this problem of recognition or respect between nations would become something less than a material problem.
It would become a contradiction in socialism that you'd have to deal with different cultural forces.
Yeah,
that's
to say the same thing that I just said, only to act as though that was a deeper, more significant problem than it is. It would become something less than a material problem. So
I'm not sure that it would become less than a material problem, because cultural habitus would actually play into how you divide, how you see the way you manage your production, even within a group. And the limitation that Marxists are realizing there is that people understand each other based on language, all right? Mm-hmm. This is not actually a blood ethnic thing. This is a linguistic thing. And they're not positing, you know, that everybody, like, accept a universal language like Esperanto to, you know, parse their interests. In fact, Marx even goes further than this. Marx has theories that, like, there are radically different material reasons for races and languages to be the way they are. We don't think this anymore. Marx started to drop this a little bit when he started reading Darwin, but this is definitely in early Marxism. Like, he talks shit about the English because their ecology leads them to be rational and dumb. I mean, like, that's the way he thinks about it at first. He gets a more advanced notion of it as he starts incorporating Darwin, but we don't know what Marx thinks of this. We know what Engels thinks of it because of the dialectics of nature, which most Marxists kind of, like, are iffy about because of A, Lysenkoism, and B, it has some Lamarckian assumptions, or it kind of come up with a Lamarckian Darwin synthesis. I mean, I just want to say, like, yeah, it is not an obvious material problem, but I don't think it's not one at all, even in socialism. It's just that it wouldn't be the same kind of conflict if the social units have relative autonomy amongst themselves. In state socialism, just like in capitalism and capitalist nation states, or in state capitalism, those units cannot have autonomy amongst themselves. There's no way for that to happen.
Well, let's try to think through like a socialist situation where there would be, where you have worker run nations, or, you know, geographical locations, which were producing things, and were producing things for the use of the whole, of a universal humanity, right? Of a classless society. But nonetheless, they had their own, each part of the world had its own cultural understandings and religious traditions, and therefore they had certain kinds of needs that were, you know, unique to those peoples, right? Mm-hmm. So what you'd be talking about then is negotiation between peoples of production to meet needs which weren't uniform.
Correct. So
right. I mean, that's where we would see conflict arise, perhaps, in the management of the self-management of production for use.
Right. And then this would be settled somewhat democratically with some respect for minority rights within the international. That's the idea.
Right. But the other idea with Marx is that you would have a very industrious and productive world.
Yeah.
In which, for the most part, the most substantial needs, which would themselves be culturally, tinged. It's not like you're going to ask, let's say, Asian people to stop eating rice and all eat, Soylent Green the whole world over, or some
right,
shit like
because,
that.
I mean, thought that like Asian people were evolved to eat rice because it grows there, and why don't we just grow more there because they're going to
whatever, whatever.
But I mean, like, seriously.
I know, but you don't have to think that. You just have to think like people might want to eat things based on what they're used to in their traditions, and, you know,
and what's immediately available and doesn't require a whole lot of extra resources to transport.
Right, exactly. All that. And so the point is that you don't have to require that everyone becomes the same in order to create a situation, if you're particularly industrious and particularly productive, where those kinds of needs that are culturally tinged could be met by and large. But then there are other things that might be much more difficult to produce and that might require more coordination internationally, which would have to be worked out cooperatively. And I wouldn't even say that this will become a political problem, but it may be a point of conflict. It could be a problem.
I mean, what is a political problem when you don't have the nation state as we currently know it? And right. That is not to say we don't have a government. But one of the other things I see keep on talking about the is a lot of these people don't trust people to like educate themselves to make conscious decisions. This actually says that the state can do that, but the state is as good as its planners. Mm-hmm. Like the notion of the state as an absolute idea actually is an idealistic notion in which the state somehow emerges as separate from any force within it, can pick its planners. The only people who've really argued for it are ancient Chinese legalists, which Mao was fond of, but even he didn't totally believe, and fascist, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because even LaSalle didn't think the state was that abstract. That's why he had a softness for a strong monarchy as an enlightened despot, a singular authority to which classes could appeal, hemmed in by some kind of force of law. He doesn't see the monarch as absolute. So while he distrusts general constitutionalism, he doesn't think a legal framework must supersede sovereignty. He's not Carl Schmitt. Mm-hmm. But this is still how he sees that there's like one figure that you can appeal to. But what the funny thing about that is that's the way pre-modern empires work. Like you'd have like a noble class. When the noble class out of line, the commoners are the proto proletariat or the agrarian peasants or whoever would appeal to the central authority against the intermediary class who was closer to power and thus was trying to assume power against the singularity sovereign. That's how a lot of tributary modes of production worked. By that, you know, what Marx calls Asiatic despotism. I don't like that term. I think tributary mode of production is more descriptive. That's how the ancient Roman Empire worked. That's how like England worked, actually. So that notion of authority is a pre-modern notion that's kind of carrying on.
Yeah. Let's take some questions here, and I want to encourage people. I know we're over an hour, but I want to take a few questions because people are popping them up here, and I want to encourage people to use Super Chat if you can. It's helpful to us and makes these live streams seem worthwhile when people chip in a buck or two on the Super Chat. So please do. Corey Clark says, wouldn't labor as a central motivating political force carry its own blind spots internationally just as an elite class would? Can I give it a shot?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, okay. First of all, it would not be a central political force. Labor would actually, as we understand it now, would be gone. There would not be a working class that was subservient to the needs of capitalist accumulation. So labor's goal through revolution is to abolish itself and form a classless society. And in a classless society, there are different things you can say about it. What would that be like? One of the things that I think it would be like is that people would contribute to society productively and creatively. So yeah, would there be a group of people who would be working creatively to meet their own needs together? Yes. Would that constitute a class? No, it wouldn't. And it wouldn't be necessarily political. That's one of the things that Marx thought and that we've been discussing all along, is that the state would wither away because the political formation rose up out of contradictions based on the social relationship in around the means of production. In other words, the need to bring people together to create this abstract value for exchange rather than the aim of meeting people's needs. Would be worthwhile, Derek, for you and I to talk about, you know, the problem, some of the problems in Marxism that might involve simplifying what human needs are too much. And yeah, I think a mediating structure for our relationship is kind of a human need, whether it doesn't have to be this one. But nonetheless, that would be my answer. So no, labor wouldn't be an elite group. There wouldn't be any ethnic identity attached to it, but also there wouldn't be a particular political position within a socialist world for the workers per se as workers and in actual socialism.
One thing I'll give it some legitimacy to that question, though, is to say that in a transitional state towards socialism, that's going to be a high problem. Whatever state first declares a revolution, national chauvinism also plays into it. That stuff isn't going to immediately go away. You have to disincentivize it in the structure of whatever society emerges after several stages of.
Well, look, if you can't get past the national divisions in the working class, you're not going to have the revolutionary movement that you need to create socialism.
Right. I mean, you won't. You'll die on arrival. You're stuck in a socialist rump state.
Capitalism.
Yeah. Are a socialist state, to avoid the debate, or a state capitalist state, depending on your personal opinion, that has to operate as somehow internally socialist, but as a capitalist on the international market, which is the best thing you can argue about currently existing socialist states. No socialist state has autocracy, which is the other problem with state socialism. The only way to imagine that it would work is a world state. How the hell a world state works, no one can articulate. One of the things that you and I were talking about, though, is the COVID-19 crisis points out something that's been obvious all the way to Hobbes. I don't believe in a state of nature, but I actually do think nation states and capital operate under a state of nature because of competition for parts of logistic trains. I actually think we produce more than enough to take care of the entire world, but those logistic trains are national proprietaries, and there are issues with them. And if you don't act kind of as a wolf in this scenario, you actually fail your you're a citizenry.
Yeah, this is a good thing to talk about. Maybe we'll do we'll talk about this more in a bit, because I want to take a few more questions before we get into another chain of thought. But we should talk a little bit about what LaSalleanism, well, our critique of LaSalle, and what the history of socialism that includes him is telling us about our current moment. And I think we should do that in just a bit. But let's see if we have any.
Give us the cool questions.
Yeah. Someone says you have to ask people to give them. So I just like what state socialism says, because it's always so infuriating to me. You have to ask people to give them up and work towards a socialist identity. I'm just like,
okay, well, what is a socialist identity? What transform? Like, how do you even decide that if your sole arbitrator is the state, and whose state? And since in our mind, like, we're saying state as if state can be separated from nation state. In LaSalle, it can't. All right, because the nation is ruled by its language. All right. Again, this is not even this doesn't necessarily get into blood and soil nationalism, although that's part of it. It's more just like, you can't operate outside of your linguistic group, because, like, how are you going to talk? So.
Right. But I mean, you can talk to people who don't speak your language if you have people who can.
If we have like universal Esperanto, but that was seen as a liberal cosmopolitan dream.
Well, you don't even need Esperanto. You can just have, you know, a class of people who can translate for you, or Google. Just have Google Translate, a really good one, in a little box, you know.
Yeah,
little.
Not a possibility in 19th century though.
all right. Let's see. So people are more talking to each other than they are to us, and we haven't gotten any super chats. So I'm tempted to end it here, and then maybe do the next stream in just a minute with you. So for our people on Patreon, someone's laughing at, says they're laughing at my reaction to state socialism. So, which is not the concept, but the viewer. All right. Well, listen, why don't I just play the outro, the same thing which brought us in, and we'll take a little break, and then we'll do the second half of this thing.